mailing list, and I'm sure he'd be happy to put you on his mailing list. He does have a weekly radio show. It's every Sunday at 1 o'clock up in North Texas. And so I listened to the one that was there that you had this last time, and it was very interesting. And what I'd like to say is I'm going to leave it up to you, and I'm going to bow out after this and let everybody else ask questions as they see fit. But some of the things that came up in that I thought was very interesting is the moderator asked you, since you've been in your position for so long, you have dealt with a lot of different epidemics. And of course, HIV was way before your time, but it's still going on. And so you got caught up in that anyhow. And I had just read that the pledge is to finally end that epidemic. It started in the 80s, but the pledge is to end that epidemic by 2030. So that'll give you some idea as to how long epidemics can last. But he was also involved with the Ebola and Legionnaire and hepatitis C. And so I think that's interesting to see how this compares with some of those, Steve. So if you could touch on that. We'd like to hear what your plan is in the DFW area. You've been looking at modeling and predictions and so forth. If you could talk to us a little bit about that. Is a surge coming? That was something I think we all wonder if it's coming, what you all predict on that. And also where we as a state of Texas and we as a country stand in terms of what our state legislature is doing, what our state government is doing for our for Texas, but also generally for the U.S., what the government's doing and your thoughts on that. So with that, I'm going to mute out and leave it up to you.
Well, thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be with all of you today. I know we've got people from across the state and also Atlanta, and I used to live in Atlanta. I was in Georgia for 20 years. I was born and raised in Virginia, lived in Georgia, so I have a crazy accent. So a lot of people think I'm from Louisiana, but I'm not. But I want to thank Linda. It's really an honor to be able to do this. I thought what I would do is try to touch on all the things she mentioned, but just give you a little background on what we're going through and why this is a little different than some of the other things we've dealt with. I sat down with some infectious disease physicians at UT Southwestern here in Dallas, and also some from some of our hospitals, and went through the coronavirus. And many of you may or may not know this, and forgive me if I'm being repetitive, but the coronavirus has been around quite a while. In fact, the common cold is a form of coronavirus. However, SARS is a coronavirus, and SARS was a mutation that came out of the coronavirus. MERS, which is the Middle East, which also came out, was a coronavirus. So when this came out of Wuhan, China, in the latter part of December, it was definitely determined to be a coronavirus, but it was new. No one had ever seen this type of virus. Thus, it was called the novel coronavirus, and then subsequently named the COVID-19. Now, in talking to the infectious disease physicians, the way they explained it to me, and I'm not a clinician, I'm more in hospital administration, but the way they explained it to me, when you go back to SARS, when we had the SARS problem, it really came from a bat. And you have to have an intermediary. And there was a bat and also a cat that were the carriers and the intermediary of this virus. And then it came back to humans. MERS, the Middle East virus, the intermediary was a camel. And so it actually was in a camel and then came back to humans. And I said, well, in COVID-19, what is the intermediary? And they said, we don't know. That's one of the things we've got to find out, and it will help us as we develop a vaccine. There's theories. Many think it is the bat, that it's a derivative of one of the viruses that was in a bat, and it came back to human. So we don't know. So I asked them about a vaccine. They feel like in the next 60 to 90 days, there's going to be vaccines, but they have to go through clinical trials. And they said it's probably going to take a good year before we get a vaccine. The other thing I asked them is, will warm weather impact this? And they said, we don't know. In the studies that we've done, in the laboratory work we've done, the general consensus now, unfortunate for us, is it's going to reoccur like the flu. So it's not going to be one and done. That's kind of what SARS was. There's actually a vaccine for SARS, but it was developed after SARS pretty much had run its course. And so we still have the vaccine, but fortunately, we don't have a lot of recurring SARS viruses. So I asked them also, what did they think was unique about this virus? And they said it can mutate about every 14 to 21 days. And that was really what was the warning sign when they found that out in Wuhan, China, in the early part of January, and why many of the people, infectious disease, that studied this feared it could become pandemic. So where do we go from here? What about Texas? Where do we stack up? Based on everything that I've seen and in talking to, epidemiologists running the different models, we probably are somewhat fortunate here. And let me explain to you why. When I talked to the epidemiologists, they said one of the reasons Italy has had such a time with this, it's in the culture that many Italians live in the same structure. The grandparents, the parents, the grandkids all live together as a large family unit. Unfortunately, then, when a real contagious virus comes along, it infects more people quicker than it normally would. So then I asked them about New York, and they said two things that was unfortunate for New York that has proliferated this virus is the density of the population. And don't get me wrong, the state of Texas has 28 million people, but we're spread out. I know Houston's big, I know Austin's big, San Antonio, we got 7 million people up in DFW, but it's not like the density in New York. The other thing, most people in New York either ride the subway or ride trains, and they're like petri dishes when you get a virus. So there are some things unique about our region. And you could say, well, what about Louisiana? I think, unfortunately, Mardi Gras hit at the same time the infection rate did, and that's why New Orleans is having the problems they're having. There's some epidemiologists that really think, had Mardi Gras not occurred, and I'm not being critical that they held Mardi Gras, I'm just saying if it had been a different time of the year and not during Mardi Gras, probably New Orleans would not be going through what they're going through now. So how has Texas done overall? Most epidemiologists think we've done okay, but we probably could have done a little better. I will tell you, on March 21st, the hospital council, and Linda talked about it, we represent 90 hospitals here, in meeting with our infectious disease docs, looking at the models, and the models we've looked at, there's one called COVID-19 Act Now. Neil Ferguson, who is out of the Imperial College in London, is another epidemiologist who's done a lot of work. There's the Becker model. The University of Texas has done models. All the models are a little different, but essentially what they do is look at the population, look at the age of the population, look at what the infection rates have traditionally been by age group and by gender, and then they project out what they think the infection rates will be. From that, what will be the percent of those people that have to be hospitalized? As you know, some models show 20%, that one in five people are hospitalized. Others show 15, others show 10. Most of them are somewhere between 8 and 10% of the people that get infected go to the hospital. Once they're in the hospital, some may not even need to go to critical care or intensive care. They may not need a ventilator, but they may need isolation, and they may need other treatment, especially if they've got underlying problems like congestive heart failure, or if they've got diabetes, those kinds of things. So Texas, we, on the 21st of March, we, the Hospital Council, contacted Governor Abbott, and we asked for three things. We said, one, we want you to pull down as much federal aid as possible to help the state of Texas. Two, we really are worried about workforce, and we know that there are a lot of nursing students that are going to be graduating in the next 4 to 6 weeks, and they have to do what's called clinical rotation, where you do it in a hospital or you do it in a clinical environment before you can get certified as a nurse or licensed as a nurse. And we want you to waive that if they can do it virtually, if they can do that training virtually, because we need those people in the workforce. And the reason we want to do that is we know that this surge is coming. We can't do the clinical rotations because even a student has to put on protective gear. We call it PPE, personal protective equipment. We wanted to conserve that. We weren't going to use it on students when we know we'd need it for patients and for our healthcare workers. And then the third thing we asked the governor, would you immediately put in place a statewide stay-at-home order? Well, he agreed to two of the three. And the one he wouldn't agree to is a statewide order. And he said, we're going to leave that up to the mayors and the county judges. Now, we're in healthcare, we're not in politics. So we treat Democrats and Republicans in our hospitals. So I don't get into politics. But when he chose to leave it up to the county judges, that particular night, our county judge did put in place a stay-at-home order. So Dallas County was the first county in the state to do that. Now, other counties followed. And subsequent to that, as you know, for the most part, 2 weeks later, Governor Abbott did do a stay-at-home. I think the only really real difference or exemption was religious gatherings, as long as they stayed 6 feet apart. But we still, in Texas, put social distancing, stay-at-home, essential businesses operate in place much earlier than New York did it, than Chicago did it, than Seattle did it. 4 weeks ago, we were a hotspot. The state of Texas was a hotspot on the map that most of the epidemiologists ran, saying we probably are going to have pretty high rates of COVID-19. The good news, all the work we've been doing, the cooperation of all the citizens, we now are showing that we are really compressing and pushing down on that curve. We're flattening the curve of infection. Why is that important? If we can flatten that infection rate and spread it out, it means the capacity in the hospitals hopefully will accommodate the people that are sick. And even though we'll have a surge, that surge hopefully will not exceed capacity. But there are other things you got to consider when you have a surge. It's not just do you have the bed capacity, do you have the PPE, personal protective equipment, and do you have the workforce, and do you have the ventilators that you need? That's what's critical. The state of Texas has done well. I know the hospitals in Houston have worked together, the ones in San Antonio and Austin. The ones I really worry about also are the rural hospitals. Many of our rural hospitals are barely making ends meet. They really are. They're right on, you know, payroll to payroll, can barely make payroll. As part of this, to free up capacity and also to limit and keep people distant, hospitals were ordered to stop elective surgery. That really hurt rural hospitals. Rural hospitals, one of their lifelines and revenue streams is elective surgery. So they're getting a double whammy. So if you know hospitals, say thank you to the hospital workers, but especially those rural hospitals. Now, to kind of address a little bit what Linda was saying, I am an old guy. I do remember going through SARS. I remember going through MERS. I remember H1N1. I remember Legionnaire's disease. I'm so old, even though Dr. Salk and Dr. Savin had come up with the polio vaccine, when I was 7 years old, I remember standing in line at the fire station to get a sugar cube that had the polio vaccine on it that was given out public health-wise throughout the nation. One thing I will tell you, because I did March of Dimes work here in Dallas, I never knew this. The worst city for polio that had the highest rate per capita in the United States was San Angelo, Texas. San Angelo, Texas was off limits. They actually quarantined the entire city because so many young children were getting polio. Their books have been read about that. It's very, very sad. But swine flu, Legionnaire's disease, MERS, SARS, we've been through this. Yes, Ebola came to Dallas. And to kind of address what Linda was saying, Ebola's a little different. When I sit down with the experts, I know Ebola really upset people, and I know people freaked out about it and panicked. Here's the thing about Ebola. 75% of the people that had Ebola, especially in third world nations, would die. It's a very high fatality rate. But as far as being contagious, hepatitis C is more contagious than Ebola. The only time Ebola is really contagious is where the individual that has Ebola is in like the final few days of their life, and they're running very high fever, and they're extremely contagious. But even then, it's kind of like hepatitis C. You can get that easier. This is just the opposite. This disease, the mortality rate is not near as high. It's 2 to 3%, but any death is too much of a death. But it's so much more contagious. It's 5 times as contagious as the flu, according to the epidemiologists and the infectious disease doctors I've talked to. That's why there's been such an emphasis on washing your hands and covering your mouth and all the things that you've heard about this. And if we can slow the spread and the infection rate, then we're going to save lives, especially for the first responders and the people that work in the hospitals. I think the other thing Linda mentioned that is unique about this is how some communities have responded better than others. I think New York, unfortunately, responded later. They were more dense, as I said. They had more public transportation, and everything worked against them. Seattle became a hotspot because, unfortunately, as you know, it entered Seattle through a elderly community in the skilled nursing, et cetera, where it spread. So what are we really trying to do? It's two main things without a vaccine. Flatten the curve by doing everything we can to stay at home and social distance, and then test. We have got to test more and more and more. And the reason you want to do more testing, you can identify those hot spots like nursing homes or areas of your community where you have to contain. So on behalf of all the hospitals and all the hospital workers and the first responders, all of you that are observing, stay at home, doing your social distancing, we thank you. We got a long way to go. All the models show in the DFW area, which I think is going to be pretty close for Texas, the increased volume, and hopefully we're going to continue to push that down and down, but I'll still use the word surge, is around the first week of May. First week of May until maybe the 10th of May is where we think we're going to hit the peak, and then we're going to start going down the other side. I know it's hurting small business. My heart aches for small business owners, but I think we have to look at public health first. And then when this is over, we've got to all work together to help business and industry and the economy and help people get their jobs back. We've learned a lot of lessons from this. Whoever thought, they call this the beast in New York, whoever thought this beast would cripple the world the way it has. And it's done it really since the latter part of December in Wuhan, China, to where we are today. Linda, I'm going to stop there, and I'll certainly try to answer questions. I'll enter into a discussion. Got some great people here. A lot of you I know personally, but many of you I don't. And I really enjoy Q&A.
Okay, let's see if anybody's got any questions. All you need to do is unmute yourself.
I have a question.
Okay.
That was a great overview. I really liked it. So, Steve, you don't know me, but I work with hospitals. I do their analytics for them in the rev cycle. And this past month, we've been changing from a historical descriptive analytic kind of view to future, because the cash is still king in hospitals. It is falling off a cliff. Right. Elective surgeries have been canceled. ED visits are down 50% in some of my hospitals. So I'm looking at this huge downhill future cash prediction model for the who knows how long. This stimulus package that was passed in the, is it CARE? I can't remember that bucket of money for the hospitals and healthcare.
Right.
Does anybody know how that's going to work and how that's going to be distributed? Is that a state thing? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, well, from what I've seen, and you're right, it's really more questions than answers. The way it appears, it's going to be done through the state. It's going to come to the state and go through the Department of Health and Human Services. But, you know, that's going to change. You know it's going to change and how they do it. You know, you mentioned modeling. I'm still a recovering CFO myself when I was in a hospital. But I'll tell you what else is going to go up. People have got to factor in. And through no fault of the people, people can't help if they're getting furloughed and losing their job. They're still going to need medical treatment. So there's going to be a spike in bad debt in your financial projections as well. You're in revenue cycle management. People are going to have to probably increase bad debt because people aren't going to be able to pay their deductibles and co. It's not that they don't want to pay it. They aren't going to have the finances to do it. Good question.
Great. Thank you.
Other questions?
Yes, this is Gene. I might expand on his question a little bit. The distribution to the states, they're saying, is going to be based on beds. The latest number I saw was 108,000 per bed going to the states. And then the states will be able, there's not really much guidance yet on how the states are going to apportion that within their state. Also, the expenses have to be related directly to COVID-related expenses. So things like repurposing, we have in my state in North Carolina, one of the systems had an empty hospital that is just coincidence. They had just emptied it, moving everything over to a new facility. So they were able to repurpose it as a COVID hospital. And those expenses would be eligible for that money. So there's a long list of things which are eligible, which you can find. There's good guidance online already. Still a lot to be determined yet on how states will apportion it within their state.
Yeah, you're right. And how the states are going to do it. And you're from North Carolina, so you still have certificate of need, I think, if that's still in place in North Carolina. Texas doesn't. So it's going to be interesting to see when you look at beds. There, you know, in fact, Texas, to be candid, we in the healthcare industry have been criticized that we have too many beds. In this kind of instance, it comes into play that it's good, but it's gonna be interesting to see when they get the reimbursement per bed how that's going to be equitably pushed out by the state. It's a lot to be determined, and I think there are going to be other. I don't like to use the word stimulus package, more a package to help people recover from this. But I think you're going to have more funds coming down, and it could be almost like forensic accounting when you have business interruption. I imagine it's going to be very strict that you have to document it, as you said. And really, if you repurpose a hospital and it's an empty building and all you put in it is COVID-19 patients, that's probably the easiest one to document and justify. Very good point. What part of North Carolina are you from?
I'm in Charlotte, North Carolina. And one of we're with KPN Advisors. We're based in Dallas. And one of our largest clients is a big system up in Greensboro, North Carolina.
Right, right. I know what system that is. It's the only one there. It's got to be Moses Cone.
That's right. That's right.
Other questions?
Let me ask you something. Oh, go ahead.
This is Kimberly Burke. I work with Skanska. We're a contractor. I know you mentioned earlier that no one seems to know where this virus came from. But I was curious if you're hearing just within your network anything that would lead to the belief that this was man-made.
You know, I asked out of
Wuhan and the biochemical labs that they have there.
Yeah, I asked that question to the infectious disease doctors, and they said, we have no way of knowing. We certainly hope not, but you know, those rumors are there. You know, there's all kind of theories out there that this was retaliation because we put tariffs on China. And, you know, I have no idea. Maybe one day we'll know. But it'll be interesting to see once they develop a vaccine and they go through the clinical trials, if they can tell if this was just a natural evolution or if it were some kind of man-made, and we may not ever know. So I've heard those rumors, but I have no way of knowing the answer.
Thank you.
Let me ask a question. You know, usually the indigent are going to the county hospitals, and is that still the case? The uninsured people, are they being hit the hardest? UHS, Harris County, Parkland, JPS?
Yeah, that's a good question, Linda. You know, if you'll look at some of the analysis, and we're still early in this process. I mean, here it is April, and this only hit China in December. But it looks like African Americans, Hispanic, people addled below the poverty level are getting a higher infection rate than most people. And it's almost like if you look at some of the social drivers of health, not entirely, don't get me wrong, but there is more disparity leaning towards people that are at or below the poverty level. To answer your question, yes, we're seeing a lot at Parkland, we're seeing a lot at JPS, we're seeing a lot at all our hospitals because this virus, as you know, is gonna attack everyone. I will tell you this, Dallas County has got a high infection rate and Harris County has a high infection rate in Texas. And those two counties have the highest uninsured rate in Texas. In fact, there was some early indications, but I think people kind of backed down because hospitals didn't want to look like they were taking advantage of this situation. But there was a lot of talk to see if the governor would expand Medicaid right before this started spreading so that some of those people could get some wellness visits ahead of the virus hitting. But that really didn't pan out. And we didn't want to be accused that we were taking this crisis and trying to expand Medicaid. We thought that left the wrong message. But you can almost look at areas that have the highest uninsured rate and they have the highest infection rate.
Hey, this is Tim Perudian. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
We're starting to see in different facilities that they're using convention centers. Down in Houston, they're looking at Reliance Center to make into temporary hospitals. Where are they planning to find the labor for that? Most of the hospitals are pretty using most of the people they've got.
Yeah, that's a good point. We actually have one of those temporary hospitals, a 240-bed one here in the DFW area. They put it in the convention center, the K. Bailey Hutchinson Convention Center. The Navy is staffing that. And basically, it's being set up through the Department of Defense. The Navy is going to staff it. The county has to provide all the wraparound services, i.e. the laundry, the housekeeping, the dietary, the lab. But I will tell you, the one that we're doing here in Dallas, and I can't address the one in other parts of the state, is lower acuity. It's going to be people that you can move out of the hospital that are really pretty functional, that normally would go to maybe a nursing home or some step down. And you may go, well, why are you doing that? It'll free up a bed in the hospital. So right now, the Navy's going to staff that. But your point's well taken. If they weren't doing it, or if they had to pull out and go somewhere else, it would be a strain on the hospitals to then have to take existing staff and help staff that. It would have to be some kind of shared arrangement to do that. Great question.
BW, how are you doing?
Doing great. How are you?
I'm excellent. Thank you. So kind of piggyback on Tim's question, you know, there's a couple of hospitals that have shut down around here in the Dallas Metroplex, Baylor over in Garland, the old Parkland. I'm just curious, why aren't they using those facilities instead of creating a new one in the convention center?
Well, they are using the one in Garland. You may not have seen it. The Garland Hospital is going to be a COVID-19 Veterans Administration hospital. The Veterans Administration Hospital, which is in South Dallas, is almost at capacity. So they're going to move all their COVID patients to the Garland facility. Even though you have an old hospital you can turn back on, you still have to meet some life safety code things. And the old Parkland would not meet code today. And to hook up some of the essential services you'd need, it's been out of service so long you can't. But there have been about 20 properties that we've worked on and identified. I'll give you a great example. If you're familiar with Greenville and Walnut Hill, there was that Walnut Hill Medical Center. That's one that if we need to open up, we will. We try not to open facilities if we can. And the reason, we'd rather expand on the hospital campus where clinically appropriate, we might put two patients in a room instead of one. Or we may go to some of these surgery centers where we have no longer doing elective surgery and set up beds, because our staff, our dietary, our housekeeping, everything is still there. When you go off site, what you are essentially doing is creating the need for manpower, et cetera. I think the only reason Dallas County agreed to do the one at K. Bailey Hutchison is the Navy is basically going to staff it, and FEMA has said the wraparound services where we'll outsource will get reimbursed. That's the only reason you do it. But even then, you're not treating real intense people that would require renal dialysis or critical care. It's more of a lower acute overflow. Great question. Great question.
I have a quick question. Linda, are we out of time?
Linda, she asked, were we out of time? I don't think so. Go ahead.
So hydroxychloroquine, it seems like depending on what part of the country or what group you talk with, is there a, what is DFW's or your group's perspective on being able to get that drug? Or like if one of us on this call were to get sick, you know, what are the chances of us being able to get that drug to counteract what's happening?
Well, you know, I'm not a doctor, I'm not a clinician, so I go to people that are in the profession. I've talked to infectious disease doctors and doctors about this medication, and they said it's made for lupus and it's made for specific things. The doctors I have talked to, and I'm not getting into politics, I'm not going to second guess the president and all of that, but the medical professionals I've talked to said it's way too early to be experimenting taking that drug when you have COVID-19, that it could do permanent damage, you could go blind. They gave a whole litany of things to me that can happen using that medication when it's not really prescribed by a doctor. They said the thing they resent the most is they have patients with lupus, and they have patients that really need this medication, and they don't want it to get in short supply when it really can be used for a clinical purpose that it's deemed. Down the road after clinical trials and the right dosage, et cetera, it may be effective. But the doctors I've talked to, I asked them, you know, if I had COVID-19 and wanted that medication, they said we would not write a prescription for you. In fact, we would do quite the other way. I'm just telling you what they told me.
Sure.
Y'all asking great questions.
Okay. Robert, do you want to ask your question?
I'd like to make a comment and ask a question, and that is, the economy is a little bit like a patient with a disease. This economy is slowly dying. There are businesses that are bankrupt, equivalent to being a fatal result of the disease. And that is going on. It's going to keep going on. And the challenge, I think, for the leadership, both locally and nationally, is to be able to decide when you turn it around in order to save the U.S. economy and not let it all die. And the slope is pretty steep. So the hard question, perhaps for the physicians, is when can you make the case to relax the freeze that's been put on the U.S. economy?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Robert. And I told Linda, this is so enjoyable for me because for the last 4 hours prior to this, I participated in a virtual county commissioner call with the County of Dallas. And trust me, that very thing that you just brought up is what they debated about the entire 4 hours. It's not an easy question. Here's the only answer I can give you. Let's look at the models. Let's look at the infection rates. And when we think we've hit the peak and we're beginning to slowly go down the other way, when we reach a point that it's in an acceptable range that we feel the infection rate won't spread again, then we start relaxing and opening these back up. It's devastated the economy. I'm the first to admit that. You know, and I tell people it's devastated hospitals. You just heard the earlier question about rev cycle. Hospitals are taking a hit. Hospitals are furloughing people. And you may go, wait a minute, I didn't say they're furloughing clinical people. They're furloughing non-clinical people. This is hitting every possible industry there is. And Robert, I totally agree with you. I think right now you have to say, do we value saving lives? And I'm not talking about you personally. I'm talking about all of us. Do we save lives and continue to tank the economy? And when do we finally reach the point we've saved all the lives we can and we start working back on the economy? My big fear is two things that I worry about, Robert. Remember Zika, when we had the Zika virus, and they said if you were a pregnant woman, you know, you certainly didn't want Zika. It could hurt your child. Well, a lot of the people, especially males that got the Zika virus, they found out a year later started having additional complications and side effects. The one thing I fear, we haven't even been through a cycle of this. Are there going to be any long-term effects on people that contracted the COVID-19? I hope not. The other thing is, when we do start back up and we get the economy going, without a vaccine, could this reoccur? Right. And that's what really worries me. Great question. You had a good question. I didn't have a very good answer.
Okay. Let's end here. Steve, I'm going to suggest if anybody wants to be on Steve's mailing list, just do a chat and say, put me on the list, and we'll turn that over to Steve. You will get so much information from his, all of the things that he does. He has a blog, he has a newsletter. He does a lot, he's very active. So I would suggest that you get to know more of him through that. And you'll also be able to get a recording of his weekly broadcast on the radio. Steve, you've done an excellent job. You are one of the foremost experts in the state of Texas as to what's going on. And so we need to lean on you. So I appreciate so much. And you all will be able to get in touch with him and you know, ask him questions if you need to. I thank you very much for being on this. Hopefully you enjoyed it and got some meaningful information from it. Our next one, if it isn't already in your inbox, it will be in your inbox when you get off of this, is going to be on Thursday, same time. And Melissa will be sending out that. Many of you who have been going to our chapters, you've met Morris Miller. He's the guy with the germ zapping robot. And there is a massive explosion in his business, as you might imagine, even outside the hospitals, restaurants, other facilities are wanting to get those robots into their facilities. So he's going to be talking about what the world, the global demand is for sanitizing hospitals, sanitizing facilities, everything else. So he's one that I think that's on the good side, where we can hear some aha stories about somebody who's doing something, and it will help us with the problem that we've got. So he will be our speaker. Morris Miller with Zenix will be our speaker on Thursday. So be sure and register for that. And then next week we have something that's very unique, and we will hear what he's doing for the COVID-19. And it is basically a synthetic stem cell, and fascinating information. So that'll be fun. That's going to be our luncheon. So we get to watch everybody eat. And that'll be an hour and a half. And then we're still in the process. I will probably call Steve offline and say, who else should we get for speakers for the next four mini conferences, which start the following week? The last 2 weeks will be two conferences per week, such as this one. But I don't think we could have had a better kickoff speaker than Steve Love. So thank you so very much, Steve.
Thank you. And I'll ask one quick favor. Can Melissa just send my email to everyone? And that way they can email me if they want to be on the list, and I won't have to go through the chats.
Well, how about this, Steve? I'll even do better. I've been writing through the chat who wants to be added to the email. I'll just do that for you. You have your hands full. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. You bet.
It was my pleasure. And what a great audience and great questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Steve. And by the way, Steve is a member up at North Texas. We had to change our day of meeting so that we could get Steve because he's also on the YMCA board. And our meetings conflicted. So I said, well, I'll change our meeting. So we did it. Okay. Bye, everybody. Enjoy your isolation. Make the best of it. And we'll see you on Thursday.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
That was awesome.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you.